thinking about the future.
I had to tell this story from the point of view of a fairly young person who is deeply invested in the future. I mean, Della Robbia really feels like she hasn't gotten to have her life yet, and her kids really haven't gotten to have their lives yet. So when she understands that they're looking down the maw of a drastically altered and reduced world, this is so hard for her to take.
That's novelist Barbara Kingsolver talking about her new book, Flight Behavior. It's about what happens when a rural community in Tennessee is confronted with a bizarre phenomenon caused by global warming. And futurist James Howard Kunstler says we'd better dispense with our penchant for magical thinking, like we can just keep on going the way we are.
We cannot become wealthy anymore by producing more suburban sprawl, by selling more cars, by driving more and making more trips to Disney World, by opening more strip malls. And, you know, there's a great wish that we could keep on running all that stuff, but we're not going to.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Until recently, the greatest story of all time, human-caused climate change and the threat it poses to our survival, was largely ignored by major fiction writers. There was Margaret Atwood, of course, and on this show, we interviewed Paolo Bacigalupi about his dystopian science fiction novel for young adults, Shipbreaker. But the field has been thin. Now, acclaimed author Barbara Kingsolver has come out with her novel, Flight Behavior. It takes up the theme of climate change and tackles some thorny issues about class along the way. Kingsolver grew up in rural Kentucky. The people of Flight Behavior are her people. Her protagonist, Della Robbia Turnbow, struggles to come to terms with the reality of a changing world while navigating the boundaries between her poor rural community and a group of scientists who suddenly drop into it. They teach her something about science, and she teaches them something about communicating with ordinary people. Both are needed if we're to deal with the grave environmental challenges before us. Barbara Kingsolver was named one of the most important writers of the 20th century by Writer's Digest. In 2000, she received the National Humanities Medal for service through the arts. She's won numerous prizes for her works, which include The Poisonwood Bible and Prodigal Summer. Flight Behavior is her 14th book. Barbara Kingsolver, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
The action in this novel, Flight Behavior, begins with your protagonist, Della Robbia, love that name, climbing up the mountain behind her Tennessee home. What is she doing, and what does she find?
This all happens really quickly. This is a novel that kind of explodes out of the gate. As you meet this young woman, you learn a lot of things about her quickly. She's been married for more than 10 years, and she's in her 20s. She got pregnant in high school, and she's been kind of stuck in this really pretty miserable life on a failing farm, and she is sneaking out to meet a man who's not her husband. And she's never done this before, and her heart is racing, and she's in the context of a very religious family, and she's, you know, been trying a long time to do the right thing, and yet she's just kind of reached the end of her rope on a very stultifying life, just kind of trapped in this life with small children and never leaving the house. So she's going up the mountain to an assignation, we could say, a tryst, and she never gets there. Instead, she comes upon an entirely unexpected sight of what looks to her like a forest in flames. She reaches this kind of little lookout point on the trail as she's going up the mountain, and she looks out, and the whole valley is just kind of trembling orange like fire, but it's not fire. She knows that there's no rational explanation for it. She thinks it's a miracle or something like a burning bush, and all she can think to do is turn around, march home, pick up her kids from her mother-in-law, and try to get her life straightened out. However, that does not happen.
In fact, what's happened? What has she seen? It takes her a while to even find out what it is.
That's right. And it takes everybody a while because it's a very strange sight. It's something that's never happened before. And I am determined not to give this away. I know plenty of other people will, and you know, and maybe you will, but it's my job not to spoil anything. So my wish is that the reader, so you'll notice I didn't put it on the book jacket or anything. Mm. I wanted the readers to see this sight and share Della Robbia's amazement of not knowing what it is. But I will tell you, it's not a miracle. It is ascertained to be, I guess you'd just say, a freak biological event. It can be explained biologically. It's an aggregation of something on this mountainside that really shouldn't be there. And so it causes great consternation. Immediately, the media are there and scientists are there trying to understand why this has happened, and they quickly figure out it's because of abrupt changes in the climate that have disrupted the migratory pattern of a particular living thing that has come to aggregate on this mountainside.
And an incredibly fragile thing as well. I found it a really powerful metaphor for all the fragile species, including ours, mm-hmm. that are threatened by climate change.
Right. And it was interesting to research this because it's not science fiction, but it's fiction that's grounded in science. So I wanted everything about, even though I'm describing an event that has not happened, I wanted to make sure that it was realistically based on good science. So I sought out the expertise of some scientists who have spent their lives doing research on migratory insects and birds and other animals. I'm giving every kind of hint, aren't I? But just to make sure that this was plausible, even though it hasn't happened, and if it did happen, why would it happen? So there's a lot of science in the book, and that was a really fun challenge for me because I was trained as a scientist.
Well, I was going to say, so you were trained as a scientist. This book has a lot of things that are packed into it. It's a many-layered book. I want to say to our listeners also that it is just a terrifically written novel. It has very compelling and complex characters in it. It's the first novel I've read that tackles two big issues and intertwines them, and that's climate change and class.
Mm-hmm. Environmentalism and class. That's really what I wanted to write about.
Right. So say more about that.
Well, I'm very interested because I live in southern Appalachia, and I am an environmentalist, and I live among farmers and rural people, and I see clearly in my daily life how the environmental movement in the United States is kind of missing the boat in terms of talking with rural working class people. Just in general, the culture wars are getting worse instead of better. And I think that it's awfully important not to condescend, or to put this another way, it's impossible to have a legitimate conversation with another person unless you really respect that person and you believe that person has a valid life, legitimate ideas, and very good reasons to believe what they believe. It's a problem that's really frustrating to me because I am of Southern Appalachia. I grew up here. These are my people. I wanted to represent us to the world both honestly and nobly.
You know, I used to live in southeastern West Virginia, in Monroe County.
Oh, I know right where that is.
And I know whereof you speak. And one of the things that I loved about this book, Barbara Kingsolver, about flight behavior, is the wonderful way that you portray the people of that region with respect. And so much so that you have your main character, Della Robbia, being able to stand up to a scientist, someone she greatly admires, someone who's become a friend, and tell him exactly where those scientists are missing the boat. And I have it right here on page 321. She has the analysis. She basically says that it's really kind of about an identity politics. She mm-hmm. says people sort themselves out. Like kids in a family, they have to stake out their different territories, teacher's pet or the rascal. Explain that statement. What is she trying to tell Ovid Byron, Dr. Ovid Byron?
She's trying to explain to him that nothing is as simple as it looks from his ivory tower. Really what got me into this novel was my thinking about how people decide what to believe. I think that all of us go around pretending that we are utterly rational beings who weigh the evidence and reach our conclusions based on the evidence, and we are therefore right, and anyone who doesn't agree with us is wrong. I don't think that's how it works. I think that we're much more intuitive than we'd like to think. I think most of us kind of start with what we believe in, and then we gather evidence to prove that we're right. So, and I think, you know, it's not one side that does this, it's both sides, it's every side, it's how the human animal works. I think we believe information that's given to us from sources we trust. And trust doesn't really have to do with college degrees. We place our faith in people that we think are going to look out for our clan. It's very tribal or sort of clannish. I think people are social animals and we stick to our group. It's insider status that makes someone trustworthy. So we listen to the radio news commentators or tune into the TV stations that we think are trustworthy because they're going to tell us what we already believe, right? I mean, everybody does this. So the point then is that this Dr. Ovid Byron, who is a rational man as a scientist, is just baffled. He's saying, why don't you people, you know, believe in climate change? It's staring you, you know, down. It's wrecking your crops already, and this is the truth. It is. And she's saying, why would we believe you? You know, you're an outsider. What have you done for us? We are Team Camo. You know, we are looking out for each other. We are taking care of each other. You're an outsider here. I think that's a really important element of the conversation that's being overlooked.
And how does one overcome it? Because interestingly enough, I mean, it's probably been a whole lot of outsiders, very wealthy outsiders, who have manipulated the conversations in the media that people listen to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the Koch brothers of the world who couldn't be farther from Della Robbia's life.
That's right.
Who are
Little
the ones?
Does she know the people who have really manipulated information, and yet there's more to this than information. And, you know, you asked, what do we do about that? Or, how do we cross this divide? And I, you know, obviously it's not a simple answer. And there's not one answer. And I wrote a whole novel just kind of asking that question. But I think it has to do with trust. People will believe a source only if they trust it. And if that source begins the conversation by saying, well, you're stupid and I'm going to enlighten you, then that's the end of the conversation right there.
That's true. But there is a wonderful scene in this book where Dr. Byron, you know, does get to kind of let loose out of his own, inner gut.
The rational man finally blows his stack with a reporter. And boy, was that scene fun to write.
It was fun to read, too. So say what are you talking about in terms of the media here? And we have to say also, I mean, it's kind of the new media that spreads it around the world.
That does what around the world?
It spreads it around the world.
Right. This novel is also about globalization in many ways, and how no one is an island. You know, there is no such thing as isolation anymore. Even this young woman who has hardly been out of her county and has not slept outside of her house, you know, in 11 years of marriage, does something that gets her put on the internet and she becomes an overnight celebrity globally. And of course, that's not a great thing. It wrecks her life in 100 different ways. But I think I wanted to kind of tug at people's preconceived ideas about worldliness. This character, Della Robbia, is just about the least worldly person you could imagine. I mean, as I said, she's not traveled. But we don't live with the same boundaries that we used to. Everybody has access to everything all the time, and it's a different world. And the lines that we draw between urban and rural, between, you know, worldly and naive, they're all messed up. They're not what we think they are. And that really sort of wreaks havoc with Della Robbia's life. But it's also meant to incite the reader to think about how nothing really happens in isolation, and climate change above all. I mean, the climate knows no boundaries, and regions no longer have the right to act in isolation. Countries no longer have the right to act in isolation, make isolated decisions about things that can affect the whole globe at once.
And also, individuals can affect the whole globe,
right,
for ill or for good.
Right.
And we're talking with Barbara Kingsolver about her acclaimed new novel, Flight Behavior. It's about what happens when climate change comes to a small rural community in Tennessee. You know, I loved your portrayal of Della Robbia's two young children.
Thank you.
I am still a mother, but my son is grown now. But the deftness of the portrayal and of the details, I loved her older son, who is, he's 5 and a half, a very precocious kid who is very interested in science. But I also really loved the little one, the toddler, her daughter. You just have such wonderful ways of describing these children that just warm a mother's heart.
Well, thank you, and also perhaps make her want to run screaming from the room, right? I mean,
right.
It's interesting to me that children are almost non-existent in literature, especially modern literature. Nobody's writing about kids, and I spent years wondering why that is, and then I figured it out. Oh, people with kids aren't writing literature. They're raising their kids. It's not an easy thing to do both at once. But it's all I've ever done. I signed my first book contract literally the same week I had my first child. So I've always been a mother and a writer. And my kids, the experience of having children and raising children has obviously hugely informed my writing. And I also really love kids as characters. Not as caricatures or furniture, which is how they're usually used in books and movies and TV, but as real characters, because they're not less smart than adults. They're just less experienced. But it's a fascinating kind of lens to use, and I really love these characters of Preston and Cordelia. And also motherhood. I think perhaps another reason people might shy away from using kids, you know, small children as characters in fiction, is that there is, I suppose, a risk of sentimentality. Mm-hmm. But I'm a pretty unsentimental mother. I mean, I I was ready to be very clear about the fact that Della Robbia is, you know, she loves her children fiercely, and she also would be the first to tell you that they're driving her crazy. They are, she says to her friend Dovey, "What would I know? I spend my time with people who eat thumbtacks off the floor." It's taking care of small children consumes a life in a way that's very difficult to describe to someone who hasn't done it, and that's not really a bed of roses.
Right, and I'd have to say there's absolutely nothing sentimental about your descriptions of Cordelia playing with her food in the high chair, but it's one that just had me laughing out loud.
But, banging on it like a heavy metal drummer.
Exactly.
Yeah, I also really loved Cordelia. I loved making this portrait of this wild child. She's sort of Della Robbia. Della Robbia has this wild streak. She was a wild girl in high school. She ran sort of with the fast crowd in it, and it backfired on her, and then she became anchored as a wife and mother. But she sees that wild streak kind of bubbling up in her daughter, and she both admires and dreads it for what it may mean for her daughter. So that was a thread of character that I really enjoyed. And of course, as a mother, you know, there all of the, not that either of my children is anything like these two children, but as I say, the experience of motherhood informs everything that I do. And I know as a mother myself how loaded that experience is when you see something of yourself in your kid and you think, oh man, you think two things at once. You think, well, she's really mine, and I probably deserve this, whatever's coming out of it.
And then on a more serious note also, I mean, I felt that this book was written very much from the point of view of a mother. At least that's how I felt reading it myself. When we talk about climate change,
yeah.
I mean, I remember it was about 3 or 4 years ago. I have a granddaughter who's 8. I remember the moment that I realized that we are experiencing the end of the world as we and hundreds of thousands of years of human beings have known it.
Yep.
I mean, the death of so many species that our children will never get to see, the end of a way of life that's been around for eons. And
even the end of agriculture as we know it. I mean, there will be agriculture, but it will be nothing like what we've been used to. You're exactly right. That's the very serious heart of this novel. I had to tell this story from the point of view of a fairly young person who is deeply invested in the future. I mean, Della Robbia really feels like she hasn't gotten to have her life yet, and her kids really haven't gotten to have their lives yet. And before all this happened, she thought the worst thing, you know, the hardest thing she had to worry about on her kids' behalf was trying to, you know, keep them fed and intact and maybe saving up for them to go to college. So when she understands that they're looking down the maw of a drastically altered and reduced world, this is so hard for her to take. It makes her angry at Ovid Byron. It's sort of, you know, sort of shooting the messenger. She kind of wishes he would just go away. She wishes she didn't know all this stuff that he's telling her. And you as a reader, I hope, will relate to the resistance that people have to this. There are many reasons to resist understanding and believing in climate change, and a really big one is if you feel like you haven't gotten your fair shake yet, your fair share yet, and the people who had the most are kind of robbing it from your kids, that's a really, really hard thing to hear.
It is. It's something I struggle with every day, all day. And
yeah.
I want to ask you, I mean, I remember the shocking grief that I had when I realized this the shock's gone away, but the grief is still there. Could you talk about how you wrestle with this?
I write novels. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what I do when and the content of all of my books derives from, I guess, a combination of grief and hope. The things that worry me the most, the things that I most want people to be talking about and thinking about and asking themselves and answering for themselves, those are the things that I have to write about. I'm not interested in small matters when, as a novelist. I'm interested in grave matters.
Well, Barbara Kingsolver, this terrific latest novel of yours, Flight Behavior, I just want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
You can read an excerpt from Barbara Kingsolver's Flight Behavior at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with long emergency author James Howard Kunstler about his latest book, Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. Stay tuned after the break.
Well, there's the dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. But if you meet with the darkness and strife, sunny side we also may view. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. If we'll keep on the sunny side of life.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Conventional wisdom has it that we can solve all our problems, like climate change and the energy crisis, with new technology. We can hydrofrack our way to energy independence, never mind the carbon emissions, and transition to renewables with advanced wind and solar. But my guest, James Howard Kunstler, says, not so fast. In his latest book, Too Much Magic, he says we're already running out of the financial capital and natural resources needed to support the industrial society we have, let alone the new technology we think will save us. Kunstler foresees a time not far away when the internet will be a thing of the past and most people will be working and farming. He argues, as one reviewer said, that the time for magical thinking and hoping for miracles is over, and the time to begin preparing for the long emergency has begun. James Howard Kunstler has written about the long emergency, a phrase he coined in his celebrated book of that title in 2005, in several books, including the novels World Made by Hand and The Witch of Hebron. We spoke to him about the latter in 2010. His latest now, Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and The Fate of the Nation. James Howard Kunstler, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
You've got a really difficult project to accomplish in this book, which is to get people to tell people some very difficult news. And I think you do it convincingly, but at the same time, not give up hope. Tell us, what is the core, the nut of your message?
The nut of my message is that we're wasting our time and national spiritual capital and national energy and elan in waiting for Santa Claus to deliver a sack full of rescue remedies in the form of technology so that we can keep on running America the way that it's been set up to run. Instead of making new arrangements for new terms of everyday life and new terms of being civilized.
New terms of being civilized?
Yeah, of remaining civilized.
So are you talking about civilization as a technological level, or are you talking about it as something deeper or broader than
oh,
that?
No, I'm talking about just the project of human civilization, of being something more than brutes and savages, and living in a way that produces grace and art and beauty and prosperity and certain comforts that we associate with civilization, like the rule of law and the protection of institutions and things like that.
And to do this at a far lower energy level than anything that we are remotely used to at this time. You talk about this in The Long Emergency. Could you just give us a very brief, broad outline of what The Long Emergency is for our listeners?
Well, The Long Emergency was my idea of a set of converging predicaments that we face. Specifically, they amounted to the global energy problem, which is very much with us, despite a lot of extremely wishful propaganda that's been beaming out across America this year. The whole climate change problem and its implications, which are enormous, including the possibility that we're going to have trouble growing food. The obvious global population issue or the population overshoot problem in the world, and the questions of how we manage and govern civilized life, including especially the way we manage money. And right now, that's probably the system that is the most fragile and the most likely to put us out of business in the short term.
In your book, you refer to this we've passed the peak of capital. I mean, you enumerate a number of peaks, peak resources, peak oil. You also talk about peak capital. Explain this concept.
This thing called capital formation. And by the way, I think it's always important to make the point that capitalism is not an ideology. It's unfortunate that we even call it an ism, because it really just refers to a set of laws governing the behavior of surplus wealth. So the whole story of capital is the story of managing the accumulated wealth of a society and then deploying some of it for purposes of productive investment that will allow your society to continue going on. And we've reached a point where capital formation is deeply impaired, in part because we went on a debt orgy in the last 20 years, and now we have too much debt and we can't pay it back. And partly because without increased energy inputs into an economic system, you simply can't produce the kind of growth that we've been accustomed to. You can still have plenty of economic activity, but it probably has to be different from the activities that produce the sort of growth that we're used to. And to be a little less abstract about it, that means we cannot become wealthy anymore by producing more suburban sprawl, by selling more cars, by driving more and making more trips to Disney World, by opening more strip malls, and many of the other features of contemporary life that sometimes come under the heading of consumerism, sometimes coming under the heading of the suburban predicament. And, there's a great wish that we could keep on running all that stuff, but we're not going to. And unfortunately, the psychology of previous investment has got us in a kind of corner where we can't imagine letting go of the investments that we've already made in a whole set of infrastructures for daily life that have no future. It probably helps to have the most comprehensive way of looking at it so that, it's not just about any one of these things, because they all represent sets of complex systems that we depend on to live. And these are not abstract either. You can state what they are with precision. They are farming, or the way we feed ourselves, commerce, or the way we do trade, finance, which is, as I said, the management of capital, transportation. All these things are pretty self-evident. But the problem is that they have mutually reinforcing properties, so that the instabilities in one system, like transportation, will produce instabilities and weaknesses in other systems like agriculture and commerce. And that's the nature of the set of problems we're in.
Well, let's look at one of them that you talk about in the book, in Too Much Magic. I've actually heard this before, but I don't think a whole lot of people have made the connection, and you make it again quite convincingly. And that is between the oil crisis, the rise in oil prices, peak oil, and the housing bust, and then hence the financial collapse of 2008. Could you connect the dots for us there?
You know, it's not an accident that the last great climactic fiesta of the American consumer society and suburban sprawl building society occurred just at that moment in history when oil was getting very, very cheap. You know, we went through these crises in the 70s, and at that time, a whole set of new oil fields were under development. They were the last great ones that were ever found. The Alaskan Prudhoe Bay fields, the North Sea fields between Scotland and Norway, and the Siberian fields in Russia. And these were non-OPEC oil resources, so OPEC was not allowed to, you know, they were not able to leverage us with them. And so as a result, after about 1985, the price of oil started going down until it reached a low of about $11 a barrel around 1999, 2000. And that was the time when The Economist magazine put out that famous cover that said, drowning in oil, you know, trying to make the point that there was no end in sight to the amount of oil that we could produce, and it was so cheap that it was too cheap to meter, as the old saying goes. And, you know, that's when we got this last final burst of suburban building. It was also accompanied by an immense debt bubble, the creation of huge amounts of bank debt, a lot of it in the service of paying for the houses in the form of mortgages, which were then turned into Frankenstein securities, you know, because another thing was going on in the financial industry at the same time. Having left behind a lot of our conventional productive capacity in the form of factories and stuff, we needed something else to replace that in the economy. And a lot of it was replaced by financialization, which is to say the expansion of the banking and finance sector from 5% of the economy to more than 40%. In the old days, the role of the finance sector was simple. You know, it was to manage capital. But as it expanded, it started to subscribe to a new form of productivity, which can be boiled down to getting something for nothing. And that was what the creation of all these Frankenstein securities was about, the mortgage-backed securities, the collateralized debt obligations that were based on bundles of mortgage-backed securities, the credit default swaps, the whole alphabet soup of swindles and frauds. And because it's in the nature of a swindle and fraud to be unreal, and because reality and truth have to have a very close kinship relationship, all of that stuff unwound, and we found ourselves in the financial crisis.
We're talking with James Howard Kunstler about his newest book, Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. I think listeners hearing you talk about this might say, yeah, but what about natural gas? What about this huge domestic oil boom that we're having at this time? Take us through the steps about why that may be as illusory as Wall Street's casino capitalism.
Yeah, it has large elements of fantasy to it. We're talking about the shale gas and the shale oil so-called boom. And, you know, we discovered that we had a way called horizontal drilling and fracturing of getting oil out of what's called tight rock, and gas too, natural gas, methane. Tight rock is a kind of rock that has what's called low porosity, so that the oil or the gas is sort of trapped inside of it, and the only way to get it out is to crack it up. And we discovered that if you could, you know, sort of go in there and blow it up and explode it, you could gather the gas and oil out of it. The trouble is it's hugely capital intensive, and the flows are very low. And there are some additional problems. Americans have been propagandized into thinking that, for example, the Bakken shale oil deposits in North Dakota and Montana and Saskatchewan, that it's a resource the size of Saudi Arabia that you can stick pipes in anywhere and get oil. Well, it turns out that, in fact, the sweet spots are a lot smaller than we thought. The same thing is even more true for the shale gas industry. And what happened in both of these things is that the oil and gas companies set up a lot of projects where they would drill an enormous amount. It was a sort of demonstration project to demonstrate that they could get the stuff out of the shale and therefore attract a lot of easy investment. And so they ramped up this enormous drilling project, but the problem was they found themselves in what's called the Red Queen syndrome. That's a reference to the Red Queen and Alice in Wonderland, who at one point in the story tells Alice that she has to run as fast as she can to stay where she is. And that's the predicament that they're in the shale and oil and gas fields, is that they now have to drill relentlessly just to stay at the productivity levels that they're at. Now, the oil flows are not so great that they really affected the price of oil, which has, in fact, been hovering around the $90 a barrel mark for most of the year. But the shale gas drillers managed to get enough gas at one time within the a couple of years period to drive down the price, create oversupply. And part of the reason for that is it's not that easy to export natural gas. It's quite expensive. You have to compress it at great costs. You have to refrigerate it to a very low temperature. You have to put it on very expensive, specially made tankers. We tend to get the natural gas that we get from the continent that we're on. And so what happened was we oversupplied North America, and hence the price of natural gas fell into the basement. And now it's completely uneconomical for the drillers to even drill for it, and they're stuck in a predicament. And some of them, like Chesapeake, one of the leading oil producers, is now in desperate straits for survival. So meanwhile, the American public has been propagandized from the highest level. I mean, President Obama got on TV in February of 2011 and told the public that we have 100 years of shale gas. That's not true. We have maybe 7 years of shale gas and maybe, 7 to 12 years of conventional gas left of, the normal gas that's not trapped in shale. So, here we are kind of immersed in delusion and fantasy, and it's not going to help us in the long run.
And even that statement, even were we to have 100 years, I just have to interject here that it always floors me when they talk about, well, we've got 30 years of this or 100 years of that. And I think, oh, okay. And then after that, what's supposed to happen? So.
Well, it does demonstrate the human organism's tendency for short-term thinking. Mm-hmm. We seem to be hardwired for short-term thinking. It's unfortunate.
And in fact, you say that the defining condition of these times is contraction. And there are those who say that that contraction to a lower carbon future could be gradual, could be stepped down, could be easier, particularly if we do things a little bit better than we've been doing them. You see more of the collapse scenario, is that right?
Well, I would put it a little bit differently, and I agree with some other commentators on this subject who are, shall we say, out there in the intellectual ether. John Michael Greer, for example, refers to this as catabolic collapse, and by that he means a sort of stair-step situation where you kind of fall down, and then you level off for a while, and then you fall down, and then you level off for a while. I want to step back, actually, and define it a little differently, define contraction a little differently for my own purposes. Because a lot of people hear that and they think, oh, our life is over as we've known it. We'll never be modern again. And, I think it's really a different story. Reality is telling us that we're going to have to downscale most of our activities and relocalize most of our activities and make them finer and higher quality. And that's not necessarily a tragedy. You know, that could make for a very good life for people, but it would be a different life than the Walmart, you know, phantasmagoria that we're now celebrating. So I'm not a collapsitarian in the, you know, Mad Max apocalypse sense, but I do think that we are heading for a reset of the terms of everyday life and something that I would call a time out from our conventional idea of technological progress.
So can green technology, innovations, even if those are innovations on, you know, that just get us a comfortable life, not a profligate life, can they help us to make that step down in a more comfortable way?
Well, I think they can help us, but there's some question about whether we're going to be able to keep on using them in the long term. For example, we're probably going to discover that you have to have a kind of underlying platform of cheap fossil fuels in order to even fabricate and organize and run solar and wind and, you know, other commonly understood alternative energies. And I believe the key to understanding our situation at the moment is simply this, that we're not going to run Walmart and the interstate highways and Walt Disney World and the U.S. Army and suburbia on any combination of alternative fuels, including wind and solar and shale oil and shale gas and French fried potato oil and dark matter and algae secretions. We have to make other arrangements. We're not going to run all our stuff that way. Now, unfortunately, all of our mental energy is now going into the wish that we can run our stuff by other means. And I see this, you know, I see this expressed a lot all around the country in places where it's really rather shameful, such as the Aspen Environment Institute, where I've gone for three of the last 4 years. And at that meeting every year, you get the cream of the environmental movement and environmental intelligentsia. And whenever the subject of our oil problems come up, all they want to talk about is how to run the cars by other means and all the nifty things that you can do, all the groovy ways you can keep on running cars, you know, have a hybrid. We'll all go electric. They don't want to talk about things like walkable neighborhoods or public transit or things that actually might help us out. And so this intellectual failure, is really pretty tragic.
Yeah, and that is Amory Lovins there at the Rocky Mountain Institute,
right,
for example. You know, until I read this book, Too Much Magic, James Howard Kunstler, I had my doubts, as you do, about the scale of how green technology could, you know, that we couldn't manage to continue to consume at the current level just simply because, you know, there are not that many Earths around. There's only one. But I had a little bit more optimism about wind. But talk a little bit more about this fossil fuel resource floor, or not just fossil fuel, just this, you know, resource floor underneath that is kind of the skeleton on which our renewable energy industry runs on, and why we're on a collision course with that.
Well, first of all, I do want to try to clarify that I'm not against alternative energy resources or systems for using them. I'm just not optimistic that we can run our society as it's currently set up with them. But yes, there are some very fundamental problems. One is that we do have what Richard Heinberg refers to as a peak everything problem. And that includes things like ores and metals. The metal ores that we now have access to are of really inferior quality to what we had 20 or 30 years ago. And almost to the point where they're only marginally worth scooping out of the ground to process to get what they produce, you know, whether it's, you know, steel or nickel or copper or, you know, all these things that are necessary, silver. It takes immense amounts of silver, for example, to do photovoltaic equipment. You know, another problem is that without a cheap fossil fuel economy underlying this industry, this renewable or alternative energy industry, you know, you have these massive supply and manufacturing chains that are required, you know, to keep that stuff going. You know, everything from getting the metals to the places where they have to be manufactured and fabricated, to getting a lot of, you know, arcane and rare minerals, you know, the so-called rare earths. And by the way, you know, all those giant turbines require about 500 pounds of various rare earths in order to make the structure strong enough and flexible enough to withstand the great pressures that it has to. You know, even something as simple as the diesel fuel that you need to take these things to their sites on trucks. Have you ever seen a truck with taking a giant wind turbine blade from point A to point B? You know, these things are the size of, you know, they're Godzilla-sized components. So I'm just not too sure that it's going to work out the way we're fantasizing. And, instead of concentrating on the things that we actually could do, like rebuilding our small towns and small cities and places that are scaled appropriately to the energy realities of the future, and instead of rebuilding the American conventional passenger railroad system, which is one of the most important projects that we're ignoring at the moment, instead of doing all those things, instead of focusing on walkable communities, instead of trying to keep suburbia running, you know, all we're doing is, wishing for Santa Claus, really, to solve all our problems.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with James Howard Kunstler about his latest book about the long emergency. It's called Too Much Magic. It reminds me of the appropriate technology movement that, flourished in the 1970s. Places that are like Gaviotas in Colombia that are still run local power, low appropriate technology. Is that some of the vision that you're thinking could work for us?
I was around in the 70s as a newspaper reporter, and I covered the oil crises, and I was keenly aware of a lot of the activity that was going on around that in the alternative tech scene. I was especially doing a lot of reporting on small hydro, and because there are hundreds and hundreds of smaller streams in America that either could produce electricity or used to. In fact, in my part of the country, I live on a tributary of the Hudson River that has several decommissioned hydroelectric plants on it that when the electric companies all merged and, you know, got through their corporate takeover spree, they decided that they didn't want to maintain and pay for these small hydro stations. So they breached the dams and, you know, let the power stations all decay. But they're there waiting to be reused. You know, I think that those are the kinds of things that are going to be important. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Now, you've been called a doomer. What do you make of this label as applied to you?
Well, it's an easy label to stick on someone by people who, you know, maybe not don't fully understand what I'm saying. And I don't consider myself a doomer. I consider myself an actualist in the sense of someone who's interested in what's actually happening. And what's actually happening is that, you know, we're in a very strange transitional time in history, and we're faced with a challenge of changing our behavior. We don't particularly want to for reasons that are probably understandable. You know, the life that we lead now has its comforts and conveniences. It also has tremendous diminishing returns, which we don't talk about. And that's another subject of that book I wrote, Too Much Magic. The fact that there's so much blowback from even the comforts and conveniences we think we have. You know, for example, you know, we have all of this computer magic. And now, you know, most people who work with computers have become slaves to their computers because they're buried in email or other communications of some kind or another.
And in your book, James Howard Kunstler, and Too Much Magic, you refer to the world, as you've talked about here, that we need to be going to something that's much more relocalized on a simpler level. What would you suggest right now that people do to prepare themselves for that world? I mean, you also talk in the book, and I agree with you that, you know, we all have our own contradictions. We're using this energy-intensive technology, and we're, in fact, hostage to it because we don't have the alternatives. At this point, they're not in place. They're not institutionalized. What would you suggest that people do both individually and collectively to prepare for that?
Well, people at different stages of life are obviously in different situations. You know, if you're young, it's very important, I think, to carefully choose where you're going to set up your life, you know, where you're going to live. My own recommendation is that you start thinking about going to a smaller city or a smaller town. Now, it happens that small towns and cities in America are in absolutely deplorable condition right now, probably at the lowest point that they will be in for, you know, for quite a while. But I think they're going to get better. And those are the places that probably have a better future. The suburbs don't have a future. They'll just be incrementally abandoned, or they'll turn into slums and ruins and salvage yards. The cities, the giant metroplex cities in America, you know, some of them are certainly very exciting places to be, like New York and Washington and Boston and San Francisco and Chicago. But none of them are going to be able to sustain themselves at the scale that they have achieved. They're all going to get into trouble, partly for reasons of capital restrictions and partly for resource reasons. They're going to have to contract and get smaller, a lot smaller. And the process is likely to be very messy and kind of disorderly and unpleasant, because people are going to be fighting over, you know, which part of the city they get to live in. And as the city contracts, you know, the places near the center are going to have more value. But that'll happen. So the other thing is that I think it's important to live near a place that has a meaningful relationship with agriculture, because we're going to have to grow more of our food close to home. We don't know how much yet, probably not all of it, but probably some of it. And the places that can't do that at all, you know, like Phoenix and Tucson and other places in the dry Sun Belt, you know, they're going to be in a lot of trouble. And I think that they'll be pretty steeply depopulated. So there's that, you know, and then if you're a young person, there's a question of what can you actually put your time into? What can you do? What can you have a gainful vocation doing? And, you know, my guess is that agriculture is going to come much closer to the center of economic life than it has for several generations. And that's going to be shocking and surprising to a lot of people. But it's, I think, where a lot of action is going to be. But also a lot of action is going to be in business, in the sense of rebuilding the local networks of economic interdependence, namely Main Street economies, that were destroyed by the wish to get Walmart in every corner of America. And we're going to have to rebuild those, because, you know, giant organisms like Walmart are not going to survive. You can state that categorically. In fact, I would say really anything organized on the giant scale is going to have trouble, whether it's a university or a giant chain store operation or a big government. You know, any institution is going to be in trouble that way. So the finer and smaller and more local we make things, probably the more successful they'll be.
The book is Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. We've been talking with the author, James Howard Kunstler. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
A pleasure, Francesca.
In addition to Too Much Magic, James Howard Kunstler is the author of several other books, including The City in Mind, Home from Nowhere, and The Geography of Nowhere. You can find a link to his blog at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.